So last Sunday was the 19th NFL game for the Broncos and Panthers, but it was different because unlike the other 18 games, it had a special title. It was the Super Game. And if you watch the Superlative Bowl like 112 million people did, then it did something to you. And let me say up front, I don't have a problem with sports entertainment. And many people have actually turned the Super Bowl into a chance to build community, which is a good thing. And we watched it with our five grandkids, using the term watch very, very loosely. But it does something to you because everything you do does something to you. And watching a game like the Super Bowl can have an impact that's short-lived and mild in impact. But for some people, it's a part of the ongoing process, the significant ongoing process of shaping them into a life of deep discontent. So it's the shaping bowl. And hours of watching young, athletic, famous, rich athletes, beautiful women cheering, adoring crowds, paying small fortunes to watch this game, a halftime show with rich and famous musicians, and then you hear words like super, amazing, world champions, MVP, greatest, heroic effort. That's shaping vocabulary. And we talk about the commercials, which for many people is a favorite part, and it's where companies pay millions for a chance to shape our behavior. I mean, that's what they're trying to do, is shape our behavior. But the whole thing has a shaping function. And unless there are some counter forces at work to shape our lives, Super Bowl, along with many other aspects of our culture, have the power to bend our hearts in the direction of envy and discontent. And it might be subtle. I mean, probably most people here don't want to be an NFL player, but the pull is in the direction of, look at all that's out there, look at all that you don't have. And I'm picking on the Super Bowl, but the pull is felt in middle schools, high schools, YMCAs, churches, anywhere people are looking at the lives of other people, and they're often not seeing what's real, they're seeing what they perceive. And we're very easily disoriented when we look at our lives, and then we look at the lives of others, and we think we do the math, and things just don't add up. And you might say, well, that's not true for me, I'm happy, I'm content. And if that's so, then that's a blessing, that's good. But the temptation is there for everyone, especially when things aren't going so well. So for instance, if you're sick, even for a short period of time, it's really difficult to not envy the healthy. If you're single and want to be married, if you're married but struggling, if you're childless or your children are not doing as well as you'd hoped, if you're out of work and unhappy, if you're working and unhappy, February 14th is a great day in America for discontent. And it's a day when people have illusions of what other people have or look at what they have and think it doesn't measure up to what other people have. It's one more day where our culture can build discontent into us. And I'm not anti-Valentine's Day. I'm just saying that everything has a shaping function. We have this endless capacity for comparison and discontent. Now, you throw this factor in. What if you've tried to walk the path of God? What if you've tried to live for His glory and things are not going well for you at all? And then you see those who care nothing for God, who revel in their pride, have disregard for God and His ways, and then they're prospering. And in your heart, this becomes oppressive to you. So you see people who are arrogant, self-serving, blatantly and annoyingly so, and they're living the life while it looks like good and godly people suffer, and so you say, what's up with that? What if discontent is orientation to the world as it is, and contentment is actually disorientation? Maybe the universe is inherently unfair. Maybe the cosmos or God doesn't care if you do right or wrong in the end. It just doesn't matter. Listen to a psalm by a guy who struggled with that thinking pattern for So what I like about this guy is he admits he was filled with envy. It takes some humility to admit something like that. He confesses that he knows God is good and God blesses those who seek Him. But he said, I almost slipped, almost lost my foothold because he gave in to his envy. He became disoriented by his discontent. So he did the math in his head and the world just didn't add up. And he reveals his journey into unreality by describing how he felt. And he gives this timeless description of the enviable. He says, you know, they're glowing with health. They have beautiful, perfect bodies. They have powerful connections that enable them to avoid the troubles that normal people have to deal with. He probably don't have to even go to the driver's license agency and wait in line. Somebody probably does that for them. Pride is their necklace. It's the medal they wear to signify their status. So the idea here is they're proud of their pride. They are the kings of the earth and the queens of the earth. And if there's a heaven, they think that they've earned a place there. They're carefree and unconcerned about tomorrow. Life is all now, and now seems to be forever for those on the outside looking at their prosperity. But listen to what you hear him saying here. He's being honest. They're always carefree. They're always increasing in wealth. Really, they don't have normal troubles of people. No colds, no headaches, no gas pains, no sadness, no fear. It sounds fishy to me. But it's an emotional confession. This is what it felt like. And so he comes to this conclusion, and it makes perfect sense to him. I sought God, and I'm doing lousy. They've not sought God, and they're doing great. Therefore, seeking God does not pay. 2 + 2 = 4. Surely in vain have I kept my heart pure, in vain have I washed my hands in innocence. So this is the disorientation of self-pity. So his concern for his sanctification, walking the path of God, he now believes to be, during that time, he believed to be a waste of his life. What had it gained him? His life on God's path hadn't brought him wealth or freedom from trouble, so what's the point? And he's being very honest here, and his honesty isn't putting him in a good light because he's telling us, my obedience was not to please God, but to get God to please me. And so if we say, God, I'll serve you if this happens, then the this is what we love. And God is a means to that end. Now he does something right. In verse 15 he said, if I'd have said, I'll speak thus, I would have betrayed your children. So basically what he's saying, and he didn't give full and public vent to his struggles, not while he was disoriented. So he didn't post it on Facebook. You know, the wicked prosper, God's not fair. He shared it, but he shared it really after he was oriented. Now, it's good to share your troubles with friends. But when you're disoriented, it's not necessarily that good to give full vent to it to everybody, because you know, everybody that hears it, later on when you become oriented again, they may not be around to hear that. So he does a good job, and he tried to figure it out. He tried to do the math in his head, and it was oppressive to him. And the word oppressive means wearisome labor, toil. So trying to understand this was a wearisome task. It was wearing him out. And the reason why it was because he was trying to scrutinize the inscrutable. It was way above his pay grade. He was never going to understand the ways of God and the lives of others by doing the math in his head. It wasn't within his ability, and it wasn't his responsibility to figure all this out. So then what was he supposed to do? Well, that brings us to the pivot point of Psalm 17. I entered the sanctuary of God. And in February, we're looking at bridges from the land of disorientation to reorientation. And the three bridges in Psalms are repentance, worship, and obedience. And this week, worship as a bridge to reorientation. Because we move through life and we tend to see out there what we're already seeing in here. And the psalmist was looking around the world, and the evidence was pointing in the direction of an unjust God or an absent God or an uncaring God. And he came to this conclusion by looking at his life, looking at the lives of the rich and famous and ungodly. But the problem was he wasn't really seeing what he thought he was seeing. He was more blessed than he was seeing, and they were less blessed than he was seeing. And he began to see what was really true about the world when he worshiped. He said, all this made no sense to me. It was oppressive until I entered the sanctuary, the place of worship, the holy place. I was disoriented till I worshiped, and I understood. And so if you read this and you think, well, if he was so bothered by this, if he's struggling with God so much, why did he even go to the sanctuary at all? Do you think he probably felt like worship on that day? It's unlikely. He probably chose to go. But whatever he felt, he engaged God honestly, and his perspective was restored. And he began to see people who he thought were the blessed ones, and he started having pity for them. They're not the blessed ones. They're the cursed ones. And he uses pretty harsh language, but it's descriptive and accurate because God doesn't have to actually chase these people down and bring about their ruin. They're going to do it to themselves because the path away from God is a slippery path. It is a path that you'll be swept away by terrors. And the terrors are the very things that the self-confident fear and avoid, like loss of control, the illusion of control. They can't keep their beauty. What can they do to hold on to their health, their possessions, their fame? Every week, somebody who's rich and famous and powerful dies. They're going to get sick. They're going to die. They're going to be forgotten. and if they walk the path away from God, all this is without meaning. And so the reign of these human gods seem powerful and eternal, and it's all over. So it's like waking from a dream. In a dream, you can be being chased and intimidated by some powerful figure, and you wake up and think, oh, it was just a dream. He said, when my heart was grieved and my spirit embittered, I was like a brute beast. And so his envy and his self-pity brought him grief and made him stupid, he said, like a beast. Beasts are only aware of the here and now, right now. They have no sense of future. My dog, I've never seen my dog portion out his dog food. He just eats it. He doesn't think about tomorrow. Hey, this guy may die. He may not show up. Sometimes I haven't showed up. So if he's smart, he would save. And so but he doesn't, because his time horizon is zero. Beasts have a zero time horizon. But we're not beasts. We're supposed to have a long time horizon. And the longer a time horizon a human being has, the longer they see out in order to have perspective on now, the more wise they become. And we're supposed to, as believers, have an eternal time horizon. I was, a friend of mine passed away last week from ALS, and she had it for about 5 years. And I was talking to another friend about how Stephen Hawking, you know, he's lived with ALS for decades and hasn't died. And I said, well, you know, what's interesting is Stephen Hawking, from his perspective, he has to plug in as many machines as possible to keep him alive, because the cosmos isn't going to care when he dies. You know, when my friend died of ALS, she had peace, purpose, that wasn't the end of it. And so the longer your time horizon, the more wisdom you can live with now. And then here he gives, in verses 23, he gives his expression of worship, reorientation. I'm always with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And then you take me to glory. Whom and I have in heaven but you? And on earth, there's nothing I desire besides you. And I wonder if this was his actual prayer of praise when he entered the sanctuary, when he got reoriented. Maybe he wrote down what he prayed. Wait a minute, he says, I'm the blessed one. I'm always with you, you're with me. You guide me, and I live in relationship with you now, and then when it's over, you take me into glory. And he bursts into this praise of rhetorical question. Who have I in heaven but you? Ultimately, who do I have that's greater than my relationship with you? And on earth, what do I have that I desire that's greater than you? This is reorientation. How can anyone be more blessed than I am? But he's not overconfident, because he says, yeah, my heart and my flesh may fail me again. My physical body and my mind, they may go south again. But God is the strength of my life, my heart, my confidence, and he's my portion, my inheritance forever. And so of all the Psalms that deal with worship, why this one? Because there are Psalms that talk about the attributes for which God could be praised. There are Psalms that instruct us on how to worship. And the reason why is because this Psalm shows us very directly how worship is key to reorientation. It demonstrates that worship has shaping power. The guy is oppressed by the circumstances of his life and the world in which he lived, and it just didn't add up. And he tried to work it all out in his head, which we've all done before, and it was oppressive to him. It was overwhelming work. Then he did something smart. He went to worship, and he understood. But what did he understand? Did he go to worship and now I understand why that wicked person was prospering and that righteous one suffering? That's not what happened. But he did understand the righteous are blessed because they know God. And the unrighteous who walk away from God are cursed because they're walking away from God. And he doesn't have a resolution to the problem of pain, but he has his pain relieved by the experience of God's presence. And this pivot happened when he went to worship. It was his bridge to reorientation. And there are forces and choices shaping us. And often, most often, I would say in our culture, that shape is towards discontent, envy, and ingratitude. And worship of God shapes us very differently. So I want to give a brief testimony here, and I'll put it into halves, community and ceremony. Community. There was a time when I thought church was worthless. I thought there was no power there. It wasn't compelling to me. The songs didn't interest me. The sermons bored me, and the people I thought were strange. And my life away from church as a young man was much more interesting and compelling to me. The music was more compelling, the people more compelling. And then one summer, I had an experience with God that changed how I saw what I was seeing. I returned home to the same church, same songs, same sermons, same people, and I was drawn in. There was power there. And something happened on the inside of me. God had moved on the inside of me, and it affected how I saw everything outside of me. And so when the doors opened, I was there. I wasn't trying to earn anything. I wasn't trying to impress anybody or prove anything. I just had this new perspective and love for being with God's people. And now what was interesting, I remember distinctly, and this is within a 2 to 3 week period of time, I looked at my life before, which is a long time before, 3 weeks, and it looked shallow and silly. That's how complete and quick this transformation was for me in terms of my perspective. And it stayed with me ever since. Worship in community is life to me. It's not burden. It's part two, ceremony. This took a bit longer for me. I couldn't see the shaping power of the acts of worship. So I remember I would go to worship and I would try to engage, but it was just, I didn't think it was that important. What I really was there for was the interaction with God's people. I saw that as being powerful and shaping. But I didn't see how I was being shaped by ceremony. Later, as I became a pastor, I knew that I had to, much to my chagrin, conduct ceremonies. I had to lead worship and weddings and funerals. And I didn't see them as valuable as maybe some other things I could do out in the community with people. A few years later, I became a chaplain. I wanted to go lead airmen. I wanted to do ministry to people outside the walls of the church. But then I found out, oh no, more ceremonies, worship ceremonies, wedding, funerals, but then promotions and retirements and change of command. It was killing me. Mr. Non-Ceremony was doing ceremonies nonstop. And I eventually came to see what I wish I could have seen from the very beginning, and that was the shaping power of these events. You read the Old Testament, read the New Testament. God is saying, practice this, do this on a regular basis. And let me explain using the most boring of all ceremonies, retirements. In the military, retirements are a formal affairs with the reading of accomplishments and deployments and training and the recognition of family sacrifices, the giving of awards and certificates and flags. And I've prayed at a million of these things. And they shaped me. Over 19 years, I paid attention and I heard these stories of people's lives, the relationships, the value of hanging in. And I could have daydreamed my way through them, but I didn't. I was fascinated by this because I'm listening in 30 minutes and I'm hearing 20 and 30 years in 30 minutes. And I'm taking it in and it's shaping me. The heart and the will is being shaped over time, even when we're not aware it's happening. But in order for that to happen, most effectively, we have to engage, not just daydream. And so I have a vision for shaping events now. Ceremonies, all kinds, even what was at one time my most dreaded of all ceremonies, weddings. I had this vision for the shaping power of weddings. And some of you who are young, maybe some of you who are old, are saying, Terry, this can be explained very simply. You are not old, and now you are. And old men tend to get this way. They get sappy and nostalgic, so it's understandable. We're okay. But I think it's less about nostalgia and more about vision, because when I engage these ceremonies, I don't feel moved by warm feathers as much as I feel moved by vision. So when I watch couples get married and I see a brand new family formed before my eyes that didn't exist before, and I hear them make promises to God and to each other, then I remember my own promise and it increases my resolve to keep it shaping. Go sit through a funeral. And I sat through a lot of them. You can listen to a person's entire life unfold in a single hour. Now, in retirements, you know, it's just their life up to that point. In a funeral, it's done. You hear beginning to end. And I go to those things and I reflect and I think, you know, what matters most at the end matters most now. Go live that way. So a wedding can be a focus on the power and importance of a promise. A funeral is a focus on the brevity and importance of life. And worship in community is this ongoing celebration and focus on the reality of God, who is our very reason for existence. And so we sit, we stand, we sing, we pray, we have communion, we listen together for God to speak through His Word, and all this is to orient us to what's true and real. Because we live in a disorienting world. We live in a world with jobs and cars and kids and addictions and bills and illnesses, a world where militaries are marching and presidential elections are going on and refugees are being pushed from here and there, and it all can seem random. It's a world where the godless thrive and the godly suffer. It's a crazy world. It's a shaping world. And here's what we know. God, through the ages, has said, worship me alone. And he said, stop working. Be still. Stop producing. Stop trying. Now come over here and worship. Okay, good. Now go back out and work. But live in the world as it really is now. And that's a shaping function of worship. Read the Bible. It's all the way through there. Atheist Bertrand Russell was once asked what he would say to God if God met him in the afterlife, and God said, why didn't you believe? And Bertrand said, I tell him, not enough evidence. That's just not true. It's absolutely not true. The created order, the heavens declare the glory of God. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Human history, God picked the people and kept them against all odds. And then he has his new people, the church, and he's keeping them against all odds. In the most oppressed part of the world, the church is growing. He wrote it down. We have a written record. It's an amazing book. He showed up, personal visit. No one in the history of the world like Christ, God incarnate. He still shows up. I meet people every week who he's changing their lives. He's still showing up. And then there's what Solomon called in Ecclesiastes, eternity in our hearts. Our hearts are drawn to him. There's plenty of evidence, but I want to land on that last point and apply it to worship as reorientation. You know, when we pay attention to our longings, really pay attention to our longings, we see that we're made for worship. Our joys, our longings, our desires, our passions point to something beyond them that's much bigger. We are lovers. We are worshipers. Even the things that capture our hearts that are destructive or disoriented, they still reveal something about us as people. Our hearts are made to be captured, drawn in to worship something larger. And we're going to love, we're going to worship, we're going to delight in something. And really, if we pay attention, all these longings and all these roads, they don't lead to God, but they lead to the fact that our hearts are made for God. The desire for control that many people have, our demand for control, this need to be safe. I'm afraid. I'm weak. But I can't look that way. I can't be that way. God is our security. The desire for pleasure. I want to feel happiness. I want to feel fulfillment. I don't want to miss life. God is a source of lasting joy. This longing for acceptance and to be known and respected. I want to have relationship. God is love and relationship. This need to have impact, for our life to mean something. God is ultimate meaning. Even the desire for things. People have this sometimes insatiable quest, thirst to collect things. It's this inside of them, they don't want to miss the best of life. And they've been told things are the best of life, where God is true blessing. All these hungers that get perverted, they point to God. The desire for music, art, entertainment. I want to experience creativity. I want to experience the beautiful in a world that sometimes has a lot of ugliness. God's a source of all creativity and beauty. So all that your heart's ever been drawn to points to the reality that your heart was made to worship Him. And it can be very helpful if you'll stop and reflect on that. I did this week. Do I love you, God? Do I delight in you? And I reflected on how these longings in my heart, they point to Him. My heart's always set on a path, searching for meaning and peace and impact and relationship, and that path to God is the only path. And so when I worship God, I'm reorienting myself to the one that my foolish heart has desired but has not necessarily been pursuing. So Psalm 37:4, delight yourself in the Lord, He'll give you the desires of your heart. Delight yourself in God, and He will give you what? God. He'll give you Him. And worship is reorienting ourselves to the reality that we're made by Him and for Him. You can't force yourself to enjoy somebody. You can't force yourself to love or want somebody. But you can choose to worship Him. And when you're worshiping Him, when you're engaging worship, especially over time, you can realize, oh, it is you I want. It wasn't that. It wasn't that. Oh, yeah, that's right. I don't have to fear them or fear that happening. A friend of mine walked up to me this morning after first service, and he'd been anxious about his vocation. But he comes to worship, and he said, you know, this is my thing. This is what I do. I get anxious about my vocation. And I said, yeah. I said, I've got my thing, and I'm going to have my thing until I die, but I'm not going to accept it. I'm going to keep coming here in private worship and public worship, and I'm going to keep orienting myself to what's true and real. Worship is a pathway to contentment. It's reorientation to the world as it really is. And so I concur with this guy who wrote this psalm. My flesh and my heart, they often fail. But the fact remains, when I have delighted in the Lord, He's filled my heart with deep satisfaction. I've always found that to be true. And that is ongoing proof positive that my heart was made for Him. And worship continually reorients us to this reality. So don't despair if you say, why is it that, Terry, I can come to worship or go to group or and I go out into the world and I get so quickly disoriented? That's the way it is. We leak. We need continual flow, fulfilling of the Lord in our lives. So don't despair of the fact that you leak. Choose to continually have this ongoing flow of reality into your life. Let's pray together. Just be still and talk to Him, or just be still and listen to Him. Thank Him for another opportunity to reorient yourself to what's true and real about the world.